Caromcast. Welcome to the Caromcast, episode 19. Today I will be interviewing Jesse Vigil of Psychic Bunny and Sam Roberts of the Indiecade Fest about indie games. It's something that's been around for a long, long time, and yet it's emerged as a brand new art form, a form of entertainment and expression in ways that simply weren't possible before. There are more tools available to more people than ever before, and we are seeing bright and exciting ideas that bring together music, painting, digital art, storytelling, filmmaking concepts, and much, much more. Jesse and Sam have put together a new company called The Singularity, which will be a sort of record label for these new indie game developers, and we're going to talk to them on the phone right now. The model Sam was telling me about was inspired by the Motown imprint and the way that they worked with artists in development there. I'm going to let you elaborate a little bit on that.
Motown's very much our inspiration. The thing that was amazing to me about Motown is that Motown did an unparalleled job of identifying artists who were being overlooked by the mainstream industry and who were unable to get their recording careers and touring careers started. They were often playing with subpar bands. They didn't know how to record an album. They didn't know how to get that album released. They didn't know how to book gigs. And Motown would sign these artists to the label where they would have a job. They would no longer be a starving artist. It would pair them with recording engineers and producers who knew exactly what they were doing and were very professional in the studio. It would give them one of the best backing bands in the business. They would cut an album for them and then market them, book them in concerts, and produce and release the album. And then after doing a few albums with the Motown label, most of these artists were then self-sufficient, had built up enough popularity that they were able to be successful recording artists of their own right, to move off and just do the work that they had always wanted to do. So that's really our goal. The primary difference is that in return for doing these things, Motown took everything. When you recorded an album at Motown, Motown owned the masters, the song, they owned everything. We don't want to do that. We are getting a profit participation in everything that we directly release to the label, but the core intellectual pieces of property we're going to leave is the possession of the developers, so that when they go off and start their own companies, they have some IP to work with, and they have IP that's linked to a brand that they've been able to build up while they're working for the Singularity.
One of the reasons that we chose to structure it this way is because indies are protective of their ideas and their work, and one of the reasons that they decided to do something independent is because they didn't like the way the rest of the industry was handling some aspect of the business or the artist management. So we felt it was really important that we structure the label in such a way that it was attractive to them, because indies are doing some really incredible things, really pushing a lot of the boundaries in the industry and, you know, exploring a lot of new genres. So, you know, to get access to that, we needed to make sure that we were a place that they would want to come and do those things.
It makes me feel more like what happened with the independent labels in the late 90s, actually, when the initial indie boom started to shift. And you saw artists like the Brian Jonestown Massacre doing deals with their indie label, who was functioning sort of more as a distributor and a facilitator, but Brian Jonestown was basically able to release whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted. They were participating almost at a 50-50 split, and it was a necessary thing so that both sides could survive. Brian Jonestown wouldn't have had the energy to do all the promotion and marketing and further development on their own, especially knowing what they were like. And what's more, the indie really had no choice at that point. I mean, it was sort of a trial thing. It seemed to go pretty well for them, but it reminds me more of that era than of Motown. The thing about Motown was you really didn't have another way of putting out a record. You couldn't really put out independent records in that era and compete and figure. But now the distribution systems that are available, I'm talking about the very foundation, just even the internet itself, kind of changes that bottleneck, right? There is no real bottleneck.
The games industry has some ways to release products independently all on your own. You know, the iPhone, you can just put something on there. All three consoles now have direct download, which is a less rigidly controlled system, but it's still pretty rigidly controlled. You have to go through console manufacturer. They don't just let you publish anything. It also requires quite a bit of money and investment that the average individual won't have. And then finally, you can release on the internet through your own website, but there's no collected way of gathering attention or doing marketing properly. So in these ways, it's not too dissimilar from actually, in my ideas, that sort of earlier period in music. The costs of production are lower. It cost a ton of money to even get into a studio and record an album when Motown was operating. But the costs of distributing, producing, and sort of like getting out there and getting into the game are still quite high, and there's quite a bit of barrier in the game space.
Let's talk about that a little bit. I'm actually interested in hearing for people who might be thinking that they can noodle around and reverse engineer some starter kit. What are the resistances that they're going to meet when they want to finally take that game to market?
Well, okay, let's take your example of the starter kit or reverse engineering something. And there are a couple of really great middleware tools that are now available that are ostensibly making that process very easy. But usually there is some kind of license issue that comes up when it comes time to actually take that product out into the world and try to make a buck off of it. The licensing fees for even those middleware starter kits, if you are going to take it commercial, you jump from a couple $100 to a couple of $1,000 and on up very rapidly. So even, you know, barriers of distribution aside, there are definite costs in making sure that all of the pipers are paid before anything gets started. And if you look at then a service like Xbox Live, which has a ton of downloadable games, and every now and then you see a couple of really great indie breakouts that come along. But the queue to get on one of those downloadable services, especially Xbox Live, which is proven popular, once people start making money somewhere, then everybody just descends on it. So there are X number of slots that are available on a downloadable schedule. And a lot of those have been pre-promised to the same publishers that control the shelves in retail.
In fact, these publishers who have sort of jumped in the same way that the film industry and the record industry jumped into their independent spaces once people started making money. So these are producer-produced independent products, usually at a much higher budget level, and intended to compete with traditional independent games on the same marketplace, but are not actually coming from independent developers.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm always still surprised to see some of the games that will show up on Xbox Live Arcade that seem like they were whipped together in a garage overnight, given that the queue is so tenuous.
Are you talking about the games that are on what they are now calling the Indie Blade?
Yeah, I'm talking about the indie game market. I'm not talking about the Live Arcade. The Live Arcade has pretty much demonstrated itself to be a much higher level playing field. You know, it sort of feels like games that can be downloaded at a moderate price as opposed to the full-size $60 games you get from Electronic Arts. So it's kind of like the mid-level. I'm talking about the really small players.
The difference here between those two things is it's actually not inaffordable at all to publish a game on the Indie Blade. And there's very few barriers. You have to pay Microsoft the licensing fee. It's like $100 a year. And then you can publish on the Indie Blade. But it is impossible to make money. And this can be a multi-step process. You can publish a few games on the Indie Blade, try and build some recognition for your studio, and then hope that that gives you the leverage to put out a slightly larger product on the actual Xbox Live Arcade. But then you run into this problem where you're going to be not released for a year, and they're going to bump you further down if Capcom calls and has to release another product there.
One of the things about that Indie Blade where this barriers to entry thing sort of comes around and bites you in the ass is that there are no barriers to entry per se other than the licensing fee. There's no restrictions on content. There's no one who evaluates these things based on quality. That is, any game that is made with XNA Creators Club or the XNA system and then uploaded through the Creators Club account is fair game. It's like the YouTube of Xbox. And what's happened the short period of time since they rebranded that indie is that your reaction to the idea of indie games on Xbox has been shared by everybody. Since there's no way of telling a good one from a bad one until you've downloaded it, most people don't want to sort through that, and they say, well, indie games, I don't know about that.
I remember when this happened with what I thought was one of the more exciting music solutions. This is going back, almost 10 years, when Michael Robertson had mp3.com. And it was amazing because I, as an artist, could sit at home, I could record a track, upload it, match it up with two or three of my other tracks, and say, print on demand CD. And of course, the complaint then was, there's no knowing what's going to be good and what's going to be bad. But the joy of it was looking for that needle in a haystack, and the fact that I could just be exposed to stuff that I had been prevented from hearing before. There was this kind of an excitement about, oh, wow, like this is where the far reaches of the universe are and what kind of crazy nonsense is going on out there. That's part of what's exciting to me about the indie game movement right now is that it hasn't in any way been gentrified. You know, nowadays, even the word indie music starts to feel like what happened to the word alternative, where indie music all sounds like the Arcade Fire to me. And there's nothing very indie about that anymore. It's a definite kind of sound. And I fear that, you know, that someday that could happen to indie games, which right now are in such an incredible period of creativity and exploration.
So what I would say is that there's a ton of exciting, interesting work happening, which makes me really pleased. And you're right. Eventually, as happens in all these major media industries, it could really be brought. The term could become generalized and sort of co-opted by major media and start being used to brand a type of content rather than just sort of ingenuity, innovation, and artistry. The difference between something like mp3.com and the Xbox Live IndieGate thing is subtle, but it's actually really important to Jesse and I. One of the big reasons we're interested in independent games and in supporting independent game development and in helping these come to market is because we believe that these games are exactly what you said, really interesting to a lot of people who are, in general, prevented from finding out about them because of the way media is structured and where that they are able to show up. The thing is, mp3.com was a website, and if you found out about it, you could go and poke around. And if you were interested in music and decided you liked these things, you could spend a lot of time there and find it. There's nowhere really to do that for independent games. There are some web blogs and a couple of services that have these websites that talk about stuff that's coming out. But then you have to go usually to a second or even a third site to download it. Sometimes you can download a demo. Sometimes you can't. Sometimes it's on Xbox Live Indie Games, but maybe you don't have an Xbox. Sometimes it's only available on the Wii or the PlayStation. Sometimes it's a PC game and you only run a Mac. Because the industry is structured around exclusively gates and barriers to entry, it's very difficult to put something somewhere where an interested party can just find it, and whoever they are, play it.
So let's talk about what your solution to this would be.
Okay. So firstly, I should say that I don't really want to demonize the larger industry for not wanting to take a risk on independent games. Everybody's out there to make money, and the easiest way to make money is to make money where you know you've made money in the past. So when the games industry was young a few years back, not that long ago, they found a couple of places where they could make a lot of money, and so they're inclined to keep going that way. And one of the things that we feel really strongly about is that there are plenty of other genres, and there are plenty of other voices and ways of creating a meaningful play experience that are probably just as rewarding. We just have to roll it out in such a way that consumers embrace it.
And what would the shape of something like that be? Because I'm imagining, well, we're talking about how mp3.com was obfuscated by the fact that it was a website you had to go to and find. How would you do it any differently? Wouldn't it also be a website that we have to go to?
This is where the label part kind of kicks in. One of the things that we do is the label rapidly starts to become a brand, and it becomes a thing that has a cohesive creative direction behind it, and consumers begin to start to trust that when they see the Singularity logo on something, this is a good game. It's an independent game. It's a game like no other, and it's a game that you know you're going to like.
Secondly, as actually having some funding and production, we'll be able to take that game and, if necessary, if we think the audience is large enough, move it to other platforms. So it won't just be an iPhone game anymore, but now it will also be an iPhone, DS, PSP Go, etc. game. Or now it's not just a PC game, we've made a Mac port. Or it's not just on Xbox, it's on PlayStation and Wii as well. But regardless of giving the opportunity to actually go and get it, and doing something like making a place where people know and can trust that there is high quality independent content is how we want to attack them.
That's similar to what I did with my independent record label, Constant Change, in the early 90s, where I had exposure to this incredible underground art scene in Toronto, and where everybody was doing grunge stuff, I started going out and recording tabla players and Wiccan chanters and 8-bit artists and so on. And the only thing that tied those things together was the Constant Change logo. And it seems to me that the parallel between what I was interested in doing then with what you're talking about, which distinguishes you from being just another small brand that grows up, like Big Fish Games or whatever it might be, is that I nurtured those artists to the point of being able to record. I got it so that I would bring the microphones to their personal space and get them in that environment and get them to do something that was exclusive to the release that we were interested in putting out. And I guess what I was getting when I was talking to you guys was this idea of taking out of the gate geniuses and then guiding them through sort of a safe, you know, offering sort of a safe haven and saying, before you burn out on learning the business the hard way, let's keep your genius spark preserved and safe and get you to market.
Exactly what we want to do. And, you know, this sounds exactly like what you were doing. But to me, it differentiates us from a lot of the indie record labels in the 90s, which I don't think were about identifying early, extremely talented people and nurturing them as much as they were about bringing together pieces of a scene and putting all of that out there together.
And what's more, they wanted to take those artists as they were and then kind of change them to become more like the market. And I think that that's not what you want to do.
That is not what we want to do at all. And in fact, the singularity, particularly in the early going, we will be doing some projects where people are bringing us types of things they want made, and we're finding designers who are young, talented designers on the label who we're having to tackle the problem from a new direction. But the primary directive of the young, talented game designers we're hoping to sign will be to work on their own individual projects there at the label. And not to come up with something we want to do, but to come up with something they want to do, pass the project on up, and then we will assign an internal team to it, and a big chunk of their day-to-day work will be designing their personal projects.
Now let's go back a little bit and get some context here. Jesse, you are at Psychic Bunny, right?
That's right.
Now, is that your company that you created?
Yes, that is the company that I formed out of film school with three other film students that I grew incredibly close with, and we all had jobs in the film industry that we were not 100% pleased with.
So tell me what Psychic Bunny is about these days.
Okay, so Psychic Bunny is a hybrid media studio. So we are an independent production house for all manners of media, sort of top to bottom. So we often exist at sort of the nexus between a couple of the different main disciplines. We pride ourselves on being incredibly diverse, incredibly multidisciplinary. So we do all the way from writing through full production through post-production, and oftentimes that intersects with animation, that intersects with some kind of new media, that intersects often with game design and interactivity, and the things that we end up producing in a for-hire capacity tend to blend those in real interesting ways. So our clients have been BP, the Army. We've done work for the Bratz brand, for the Pokemon brand. We did a show in a Vegas casino last year. And things ongoing, back and forth. A few things I wish I could talk about, but we haven't quite signed the contract yet.
Now, why do you think people come to Psychic Bunny? I just want to make a note here that one of the things I discovered coming to America from Canada, where Canadians are intrinsically multidisciplinarian because of the significantly smaller industries there. In America, I found that when someone asked me at a dinner party, so what do you do? And I said, well, I'm a writer, a producer, a musician, I'm a blogger, I'm an actor. They kind of looked the other way. And I eventually learned to figure out what party I was at and answer the question, I'm a writer. Because they would think, if he's only a writer, he's got to be a great writer. But if he's all of these other things, he can't be very good at any one of them.
Uh-huh.
So I'm interested in, that's interesting to me that Psychic Bunny can cover all of that, but if I wanted somebody who does 2D sprites, why wouldn't I just go to somebody who says, we do 2D sprites 24 hours? You know, why wouldn't I get confused about what Psychic Bunny really is?
That's funny, you know, we dealt with a lot of those issues at the early stages of forming the company. In fact, our business cards at the bottom all say it's actually pretty hard to describe what we do. And that was a legitimate sort of problem. But the answer that sort of comes out of it is that we have incredibly talented expert people in a variety of areas. And so it's not that we have a bunch of writer, director, composer, artist, animator, basket weavers all sitting around in an office together. We've got a brilliant animator, and we've got a couple of brilliant motion designers, and we have a couple of brilliant game designers, and we have a Rolodex full of really amazing people, and what we do well is find a way for all of those people to work together under one roof, and it actually works out oftentimes to be a really terrific value for the client, because it's a fire and forget, a one-stop shop. They say, you know what, we build cement plants all across the world, and we're building two in Florida and one in California, and we need a way to make that seem cool for our website and for our clients and for our public relations. And so then we just go off and running, and we figure out what's the best way to go about it, and we tap all the right people, and then you end up with one of those really kind of clever hybrids. So that's Psychic Bunny in a nutshell.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. It means that rather than me have to go out and find all my personnel, I can be pretty sure that the existing network between you guys will mean there's no weak links.
It means that there is sort of consistent look, style, and level of quality that gets applied across the board, which is one of the things that really made it seem very logical to apply that kind of methodology that we've been sort of tinkering out and pioneering over to something like a label for independent games.
Now, Sam, tell me, I know that you were the festival director for IndieCade. Tell me more about what you bring to Singularity and where you came from.
Yeah, well, I have sort of a very multidisciplinary and varied background as well, actually. My initial background is in direction and production. I studied theater with a focus on cognitive science on the side, always knowing that I was interested in interactivity and on the online space, particularly in interactive story. But leaving school, I came to LA and worked as a director and a producer and a writer and a designer in theater and in film here in town. I played games my whole life, did a lot of design as a child, but had become bored with what was available sort of in the mainstream industry by the time I had finished college. You know, I was listening to new sort of independent crazy music, new cool movies, reading interesting new books, and there weren't interesting new games. After college, I started looking for them because for some time I was unemployed here and there, nothing to do. What better to do than play video games? And I discovered the independent game scene, which is very nascent at that point. Mostly it existed for people to try and find jobs in the mainstream industry.
How long ago is this?
6 years.
Okay, so we can say that the indie game industry that we're starting to identify now is sort of 6 or 7 years old.
Yes, I mean, people have been making indie games for a very, very long time. But what they are trying to do with them specifically, and, you know, this modern market where people make indie games with the intention of, like, going and trying to sell them online is something that really only started, I would say, 6 to 8 years ago. I got a job running the Slam Dance Independent Game Competition, which was the second independent games festival out there. The IGF, which happens every year at the Game Developers Conference is the first, and it's been around for a very, very, very long time. But at that point, and for all the time before that, the IGF really existed as a way to sort of prove your chops as a designer or programmer looking for an industry job. But I ran the Slam Dance Festival. We focused, since Slam Dance is originally an independent film festival and is very focused on genuine independent media, we really focused on true independence and on people who are trying to express something with their games, just the way filmmakers are often trying to express something with their movies. That was a good experience. I worked there for a few years, got really to know the space. There was a huge explosion over the Super Columbine Massacre RPG, which happened 3 or 4 years ago, which sort of ended the viability of that competition. But it also rapidly increased the number of people I knew in the space. I had to deal with a lot of these folks talking about it.
I think that that moment actually was a significant, that was actually a significant news burst that drew new eyeballs to this idea, actually. And I think that I was actually exposed at that point to the, this idea that, wow, what's this all about? What's this indie game thing that's going on where people are being that creative, essentially?
Exactly. So though it was disheartening to be involved in that and have some of the things about it go the way it did, it was heartening to me to see the number of people that got involved and were really excited about the possibility of the space. And so then I went and started working for IndieCade, running this current festival, which is very focused on artistry and innovation, and exclusively about true independence. And unlike anything else that exists, is nothing but an independent games festival. We're not an independent games festival at something else. We're just an independent games festival. But so all that experience gives me a real knowledge of the space, a background in identifying young talented developers, and a great deal of experience working with them. In essence, I'm A&R for the label, and my colleague Celia Pierce, who works with me at IndieCade, is also going to be doing A&R services for the label.
What was amazing to me about the stuff I was seeing leading up to IndieCade over this last year, I started a site about a year. Well, I actually registered this domain 2 years ago when I was at NAB, indiegamereviewer.com. And I wasn't quite sure what to do with it at the time, but I just had this feeling like that's sort of where I was going. As I left my independent music label sort of behind a little bit and was waiting to see how that was going to reform as an industry, I started looking that way, and I started noticing that the National Association of Broadcasters was starting to pay more and more attention to video games for good reason, because television was moving into deeper and deeper interactivity, and the video games industry had a real handle on this and what it meant. So I registered that, and then I started getting in these reviews from people and getting exposed to some increasingly interesting titles, not just platformers and space shooters, but then it started to get downright strange. It started to get Lucky Wander Boy on me. At the same time, I remember when the glitch scene started in Los Angeles, the glitch music scene, and I remember when this new surge of fine artists started putting on these incredible galleries all over town. It occurred to me when I started seeing this new rush of indie games that this was like the new cinema where, and again, it's that collaborative medium that can draw new attention to music and revitalize music. It could draw new attention to fine artists and revitalize that scene. And it also answers this thing of immersion, of interactivity, of technology. It was sort of solving all of these problems at the same time. And that was what was so incredible to me. And it had nothing to do with Super Mario Brothers and nothing to do with using the Unreal Engine or Doom Engine. This was a completely new art form to me. I found that the titles that were shown at IndieCade, the acknowledgement of this stuff and the encouragement to build new stuff was really heartening. You know, that was really a lift. And I think what you guys are getting involved in here, this is a whole new art form altogether.
Yeah, I really believe that, actually, 100%.
Me too.
Why don't we talk about what you guys are seeing in independent games, what you guys wish you were seeing more of in independent games, and where you'd like to see independent games go?
Well, one of the things I think is very popular at the moment and that I see a lot of that I like is this idea of cracking open the genres or game types or stories that we really recognize and know from our childhood, from sort of the early eras of the game industry, and finding ways to make them exciting again, to make them new, to take something that existed purely as a toy and find a way to make it communicate something important about the real world. These are things like John Blow's Braid from a few years ago, or Tyler Glale's Closure, which we showed at the festival this year. Both of these are two-dimensional side-scrolling platform games, but both of them go in and take the 2D platformer as an environment, not as a mechanic or rule set, and introduce their own unique mechanic or own unique rule set and use the collusion of these two things to generate new commentary and new ideas about what's going on in the space. I think this has become pretty popular in a lot of ways. Everyone's sort of secret favorite game from last year is Spelunky, Derek Yu's roguelike 2D platformer that is a 2D platformer that is constantly generating the levels as you play. It makes a new set every time. You die a lot, and you have to figure out the rules of the system to really be able to advance far, which is how Rogue and NetHack and these older games work.
We sort of saw this in Torchlight, didn't we, where the dungeons are generating new maps every time you go in as well.
Yeah, exactly. And this is something that's been around for 25 years, right? But basically, it exists in this genre called the roguelike. These are ASCII-based games, Rogue and NetHack, that generate these random levels. They're almost always fantasy adventure dungeon hacks. And even when you see this sort of thing later on, Diablo works this way, Porchlight, like, they're all the same, it's the same randomly generated thing. But again, these are fantasy adventure dungeon hacks. Occasionally you see one that's sci-fi. So Spelunky is none of those things, except that it uses randomly generated dungeons. And it's this idea of going back and taking these mechanics and these ideas that we acknowledge and are comfortable with and know really well and finding ways to use them and have them interact with each other that are unique and new and bring new ideas that I do think a lot of people are doing and I think is really exciting right now. The thing that I don't see as much of as I would like, and it's still at the point where people are expressing themselves through games. They're really using it as an art form in a lot of ways, you know, making the things that they want to see, making the things that they think are enjoyable, trying to say whatever it is they want to say, you know, what they have inside. But they're still very just personal statements when they do this. It's very rare the game that is really trying to make a point about larger society or communicate a genuine idea. And this is the thing that I would like to see more and more people getting involved in, this sort of rhetorical game.
Give me an example of a game that does that. Any game.
Yeah, well, again, actually, Braid is a rhetorical game. It is not perfect at being so. But Braid takes this mechanic, this time manipulation mechanic that he's injected into this 2D environment, and provides a lot of text about reflecting on time and looking back on time. And then it takes that, and that's the central mechanic by which you play the game. So you get in there and interact with the game by reflecting on time and looking back on time. And I'm not going to give away anything, but, you know, as you build to the end of the game and then complete it, these ideas of time and reflection and regret all become more and more centrally involved, not just in the text, but in the actual actions your avatar is taking on screen. And when you finish the game, a statement is essentially made about regret and about this way in which we look back in time and cling to it and how it can hurt or help us and stuff like that. And for me, that's a game engaging in rhetoric. It's got a supposition. It lays it out. The way you mechanically interact with it makes you look at this idea that it is stating over and over and over again. And finally, it states a very strong opinion, which you can agree with or disagree with. And it doesn't matter because now you're thinking about it. For me, this is how rhetorical art works in all contexts. But I would like to see more of it in the game space directly. Something smaller and even more directly like that is Dan Ben-Mergie's Moon Stories, which was in the festival this year.
I loved Moon Stories. Love it.
It's a wonderful, wonderful game. And it is very expressly just, in some ways, a personal statement by Daniel. But, and I think this is important, it is... The personal statement is not just, this is how I feel, but I think this, you know. It's a game about looking at your surroundings differently and describing them differently, and by doing so, changing them and making them better and more positive. You know, specifically, Today I Die, which is the third one of that trilogy. You know, you're moving words in and out of this poem, and the words are adjectives. As you change them, the environment around you change, and you can explore the different environments and find ways to move from being an oppressed girl at the bottom of a scary demonic sea to a happy, lovely woman flying through an open sky of happiness. You know, and I think Daniel's very clearly trying to say, you know, you walk outside and you feel like you're at the bottom of a demonic sea, maybe you just need to look at things a little bit differently and things will be better.
Yeah, I see your point.
So those are the kind of rhetorical games I like to look for.
I would love for that kind of effect to have spilled over into things like The Matrix. When they made The Matrix games, it would have been great to actually look at the metaphysics of that as opposed to making it just a shooting game. You know, they kind of missed the whole point and the whole opportunity. So my wish is that the indie game movement will start to refresh the thinking of those guys and say, look, you've got a $30 million budget here. You could do something really profound. And it's not that we don't want it, because we really do. I mean, really, once you've played a shooter, you've played a shooter and you've played a shooter.
And, yeah, and, you know, the thing is that that's exactly the goal in some ways of doing this sort of work and promoting it, both at Indiecade and with the label. You know, those big guys with $30 million aren't going to make something unless they feel convinced that people will buy it and that it's going to function. But we, and by we I mean the independent game scene as a whole, can make a game for 10 grand that tests out some new, big, awesome idea. And if it works, then we can show it to the mainstream industry, and hopefully they can learn from it and start adopting it into their products. They're not yet, but, well, they are to some extent small things, but generally that's still in the future.
One thing that I'll add is that I'm incredibly interested in preventing what happened to the term indie in the film industry to happen to the game industry. And after the giant boom of indie film in the 90s, indie has become a word that is used to describe things that are depressing or tragic or not commercially viable, as opposed to a unique voice that wants to do something a little bit differently. And interestingly, because most of my major credits on games are in the so-called serious game space, I actually come down really heavily on the side of fantasy. And I believe that, you know, whether we're talking about games or really any kind of entertainment, that there is an incredible social value into giving people an opportunity to explore their imaginations and live out lives other than their own and enjoy like a rich, compelling fantasy. And that fantasy isn't necessarily always running through the halls and gunning everything down or slaying monsters atop ye old mountain. It could be things like running a lemonade stand or running a business or planning a town. Or, I mean, I think about one of the games that I truly love from the independent space was Introversion's first game, Uplink, which places you in the fantasy of being an elite computer hacker. When I was growing up, when I was in high school or middle school, Hackers was one of my favorite movies, and I was just, even as silly as it is, I was so awed by how deft they were with computers and how with just a modem and a couple of keystrokes they were taking over cities and doing all these things. And that's actually the exact fantasy that Uplink delivers. And in a really compelling way, it makes you really feel like you are one of those people. And there's a lot of room for a lot of things like that that, you know, may not always stretch all the way to literary, but are different and are unique and are worth exploring.
That was the reason I think Minor Battle, which won The people's choice and the finalists' vote at IndieCade this year was of interest to me. We haven't talked very much about massively multiplayer here in terms of these indie games. We're talking about very small personal kind of experiences. But, you know, in 1990, I remember being on Internet Relay Chat and having nothing but text on the screen, and you could create a chat room, you'd go in and it was general chat, and there was nothing to distinguish one from the next. And being of the mind that I am, I would say to people who came into my room randomly, oh, you have to be careful to not walk to the bridge of the ship because there's a giant gorilla there. And at first they didn't know what I was talking about, but within seconds they started to have to respond to these parameters that I was creating, and this imagination space started to take place. Years later, of course, I got into EverQuest and then World of Warcraft, and I built real relationships that led to people driving across the country to come and visit me for some cake. I mean, it was crazy the kind of things that this engendered. Now, was it the fantasy of the game? Absolutely not. It was that we had a common goal. World of Warcraft, for example, has this very complex set of goals that kind of get increasingly complex, and they weed out the ones that are not as committed, and they galvanize the ones that are more committed, and they produce natural leaders, and they produce these whole micro societies. That is an amazing thing to tap into, but I haven't seen any indie games that are really tapping into that yet, and I'd love to hear from you guys if there are. But what Minor Battle was, just to finish that thought, was a bunch of guys from USC, right?
Right, they're classmates of mine, actually.
Okay, so they're classmates of yours who built this four-screen game, and I'll put up a picture of it. Basically, you have four screens facing outward in a cube, and they're a continuous canvas. And as your character runs, he can run off the edge of the screen right onto the next one and so on. And the idea is that as you're doing battle with the opposite team, you're actually moving yourself around this cube and creating not only a physical but a completely interactive space outside of the actual screen. And for good reason, I think that game won, because that's the sort of thing I feel that we need. Now, do you guys know of any independent game developers that are working with this idea of community and tapping into the social aspect?
Yeah, well, before I get to a whole micro conversation, first, there are actually independently developed MMOs, massive multiplayer online. Papermint was actually in the festival this year. It's a 2D massive multiplayer online game taking place, in a paper world, a 2D world made of paper dolls. And the reason it's in 2D is expressly so that artists and individuals can scan 2D drawings and artwork straight into the system and make objects out of it instead of having to master a complex 3D scripting language like in something like Second Life. And to really build a community of these people who want to play little games together. The game is always built like for sort of emergent play. Your paper doll avatar can roll up into a ball that other paper doll avatars can kick around to play soccer. You turn into a paper boat when you hit the ocean.
Awesome.
Likewise, you know, it's a little older and these guys have gone more mainstream, but CCP is a company that made EVE Online. It has been popular for like 8 years now. It's a giant sort of space opera MMO, hardcore content in general, but really well designed and all focus on building these societies and these communities. CCP is a company that the way they've gone mainstream is they got some serious investment capital and they bought World of Darkness from White Wolf, and they're the ones doing the World of Darkness MMO that'll launch in like 3 or 4 years. Secondly from that, there's a whole sort of category of games that have really emerged over the past 5 to 10 years. Well, those are called ARGs, alternate reality games, and then furthermore augmented reality games. And they're related to what I would call modern social play games. We've had social play games forever, where a group of actual people sitting in a room has a game to play. But there's been sort of a resurgence and reattention being paid to these recently, as video game designers and sort of modern people in what we think of as the games industry pay more and more attention to what those games are and what they can teach us. And so there's a lot of modern games that are relying on some of these sort of older social game architectures to encourage communities of play in the modern game, to encourage community at the table or around. Whereas alternate reality games actually essentially exist to be solved exclusively by community. They are games that take place in the real world but are fictions, you know? So you interact with them by writing fictional characters' emails, getting phone calls from fictional characters, looking at websites but that are not real, and seeing not real videos, things like this, things that are encountered in real-world spaces but are actually representatives of this fiction. And there's a great website called Cloud Makers that is a website that came together to solve the very first one of these anyone ever did, a game called The Beast. It was an advertising campaign for the movie AI. And CloudMakers has existed ever since then, looking for new args, identifying them, and then a community turns their brains together into solving them. And the puzzles in these games are large, complex things with information distributed often on a global level, where lots of different threads have to be gathered by different people and then brought together and analyzed, and often many different skill sets are needed. So they really, to solve these games properly, it necessitates a large group of people with various skill sets working in concert. And in fact, this sort of thing has become so exciting that one of the major ARG designers in the space, a woman named Jane McGonigal, was hired by the Institute for the Future, which is a California-based think tank, to design games where she is applying the community of players and their collaborative mental energy to solving real-world problems.
Yeah, that seems like a job that only Jane McGonigal could take on at this point. She's kind of like the Eldon Tyrell of the ARG.
Well, there's many other people doing great work in the space, but she is certainly the most recognizable and famous. She's also one of the most articulate. She talks about the work she does better than most anyone else.
I remember at UCLA, there was a course that we did online that was called The Business of Entertainment, and it was a 12-week course, and they took us students who were really people that were working in the industry. They were development execs, they were cinematographers, they were all kinds of people who wanted to learn about the industry. And they said, okay, you guys are going to be broken up into agents, managers, producers, and distributors. And you have to come up with a property, and you've got to develop that property and make attachments. And every couple of weeks, we're going to roll this popcorn algorithm, which was a really simple algorithm. But it had a random seed that said either the audience has showed up this weekend or some act of God or a World Series or something happened that made them not. So there was never this assurance that the people who knew more would necessarily do better. And it would leave people scrambling every couple of weeks to kind of regroup and figure out, okay, how are we going to make our next tentpole film if we just got screwed at the box office last week? And it was amazing because with just that very, very simple platform, I'm talking like a discussion board and this popcorn algorithm, we were up at 5 a.m, at 3 a.m. We were like making personal phone calls and direct threats and driving across town. It was so completely immersive that I honestly felt like after that experience, I could go out and just do just fine in the real world of doing that. And it's sort of to what you're talking about.
That's that fantasy thing too. That they put you inside the fantasy of being a mogul, a mover and a shaker, and you got to, in it, through a very elegant abstraction and mechanic, get to experience a lot of those same feelings in a game environment.
Sometimes the ideas that I see are just, they just completely blow my mind. I think I never even would have wrapped my head around this concept, let alone programmed it. I expect a lot from it in this regard. You know what I'm saying? And although ARGs are great in terms of looking around an actual city for a map or a clue or a billboard, I'm still looking for the stuff that's inside of my computer screen.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you, I hear exciting things about what some people are calling single-player ARGs, which is exactly what you're talking about. Nothing's hit the market yet. It's mostly being worked on by independent people. But keep your eyes peeled, and likely someday something very similar should be coming.
Cool. I just want to hear from you guys about how you're going to proceed and how you would talk to somebody who hears this podcast and says, yeah, I really have always wanted to make a game. I've got all these stories to tell. I can't afford to go to USC or Full Sail. How would you link them up to the point where they would work with you? What would you tell them to do first or next?
So what we've done since deciding that this was a good idea and that we wanted to really move forward aggressively with it is see what we could start on our own. So obviously everything that we've been talking about really works best if there's a lot of money behind it and some pretty solid investment, which is something that we've only just started the process of courting. But in the meantime, we felt it was really important to put our money where our mouth is and demonstrate that we could do this sort of thing. And so we identified a couple of designers, a couple of projects that we thought were really cool, and we're putting those together to get out into the market at the beginning of next year.
Yeah,
and one
specifically one of them is a game called Freak, F-R-E-E-Q, which we've been funding through Kickstarter. It's a Singularity project working with Mike Stein, whose game Empireville is actually a mobile fantasy game for a single player happening in the real world. That we showed at Indiecade at PAX 2008. But Mike has been working with Jesse and myself on this project. There's a video up on the Kickstarter website. We have 9 days left to hit our funding goal, and I think we're at 79%. Is that right, Jesse?
77. Although, interestingly, Sam, just today, Kickstarter got wind of the project in a big way, and we're actually featured on the homepage.
We're on the front page.
Kickstarter.
Yeah.
So.
Way to go.
Yes, so we are 77% of the way there. We're grassrootsing it, and how everything on Kickstarter works is that people pledge money. The money isn't actually transferred unless the project hits its entire funding goal. So this way, you're not doing that thing that sometimes happens with like crowdfunding movies where they need to raise $1 million, and so you hand them a check for $50,000, and a couple other people do, but they don't get anywhere close. And now they've got your money, and they don't have enough to make the movie. This way, we have the budget posted, it's public. We are not actually getting any of the money unless we hit the full goal in the time that we've allotted to do it. So
the website works like escrow.
Meanwhile, everybody gets a lot of really cool sort of rewards for pledging that are just the coolest things that we can think of. Obviously, we can't offer a ton of things that are like traditional, but it works a lot like a neat kind of barter system, like all the way down from, well, just pre-order the game. There are opportunities to star in the game, to write some of the quests, to get access to all of our notes. Sam and I are both tabletop gaming virgins. We've never really played a full D&D campaign from start to finish, so one of the things that we're sort of auctioning off is the opportunity to haze us in your campaign.
Yeah.
And that's what we're doing in this early going, is we're examining alternative funding models with small projects that we like so that we can essentially bootstrap a couple of projects up on our own while looking for funding. And having those projects in place is going to help us at the next level when we go for first round capital. And once we have first round capital, then we will formally hire a batch of designers and start producing our first year's lineup of content.
And so answer my other question now, which is how does Billy in out there get to that level where he can start to present? He's got an amazing idea. He's actually a brilliant mind, but he doesn't have any of the resources. What should he do?
My first piece of advice is that Billy should do something that he can show. We're looking for people who are starting and are very early in their careers, but we still need something that we can look at that we can say, oh my God, I really like this kid's game design, or I like the way this kid's head works. You know, I want to see more projects from him. So the easiest thing to do is to make something small. And depending on what his skills are and what he has access to, you know, there are systems out there that are totally free that exist for non-programmers to use to make games. They're ones that cost a little money. They're ones that require a little more programming or a little less.
Flixel, F-L-I-X-E-L.
is a system made by a guy named Adam Saltzman. He's in Austin, Texas. He made the game Cannibalt, which had a really brief spike of popularity earlier this year. And he built it in Flixel, but he's made Flixel himself. And what Flixel is it is a Flash and ActionScript library. So if you have Flash and ActionScript, ActionScript 3 is the scripting coding language you can use to make interactive apps in Flash. If you have both of those and you download the Flixel library, all of a sudden you don't need to actually write ActionScript code to make a game. He's got all of these functions that you can think of for producing a 2D game in this 2D engine called Flixel. You download the library for ActionScript and, you know, read the basic tutorial information on ActionScript and Flixel, and you're actually ready to go. You can start importing RNS and assets and sort of dropping in and building a game right there. But if even all that is too much for this kid, you know, this kid's 17, his parents are broke, he's never going to get to go to, like, one of these colleges where he can actually study this kind of stuff, then make tabletop games. Make a board game. Write a really classy design document. Paper prototype. Jesse mentioned that he was at USC with some Minor Battle guys. Also, USC grads include that game company, Genova Chen and Kelly Santiago, who did Flower. They include the guys who are doing the Misadventures of P.D. Winterbottom, which comes out next year, Matt Korba and Paul Deleza. And one of the big things they do at USC is something called paper prototyping. Which is, though it sounds really simple, a thing that not anyone does, which is just that before you start building something in an expensive way with 3D rendered graphics and wasting time on computers and like hard man hours, is you should build simple paper representations of it you can play on paper over and over on a table over and over again while you work on what the mechanics and the ideas are. And so if you're someone who just has no way but knows you can make a good game and really want to get that in front of someone, I would say sit down and paper prototype even a video game idea over and over until it looks great. And then send that in as a presentation to my festival, to the Singularity offices. You know, our website is still in just prelim. It's just the singularitygames.com. Pretty shortly it'll fully launch and there'll be a link for sending us game ideas or inquiring about more information. So that would be my advice. And then my second piece of advice to everyone in getting into this space is just make what you're passionate about. Don't make what you think will sell. Don't make what you think people want to see. Make what you're passionate about. Because then you're much more likely to finish it. And it's much more likely to be good. And the games are an expressive medium, and they express that passion. If you're passionate about a project and you work really, really hard on it, I'm going to be able to tell when I play the game. And that makes a difference to me.
I'll just add, like, two things really quickly. On the first point, I'm mostly looking for that one really brilliant aha moment where there's this great confluence and I have this, like, whoa, holy crap sort of experience playing something. And maybe you take those tools that are basically off the shelf and you've done one really cool hack, one cool thing that it doesn't normally work that way. There are great systems out there for building even like LucasArts-style point-and-click adventure games, which I have a soft spot for, or interactive fiction, you know, text adventure games. But then just do something unexpected. Don't just crank out another platformer. Don't crank out another point-and-click adventure. Do one amazing, really cool thing with it. And like Sam said, you know, sometimes it can be just a really great prototype. There's a famous sort of game that I worked on as a student with a few other people, and we say famous because it was doomed in any number of ways once we started making it digitally, but it was a game about telekinetic fish, and we built a prototype where we bought stuffed fish at the aquarium, and we assigned every single one of the designers and programmers to be one of those fish, and when we tested the level, we declared the entire room as the aquarium. And so just swim through the room. And everybody who played the game had this amazing wow, aha moment because they could feel what it was going to feel like to control a 3D avatar inside a giant 3D space from the perspective of a fish and manipulate all these objects, and all these things happened. And we had one really great dramatic moment towards the end of it that everybody loved. And from that point forward, we started doing it digitally, and our skill set was not up to doing it digitally at the time, but... Mm-hmm. So I would say don't feel like it has to be a digital game. Mm-hmm. At that point, you know, show up at our offices with a bunch of fish and say, your office is now an aquarium. Don't actually do that, because I still want to do the fish game.
Yeah, play, goddammit, like you're a kid.
And I think it's really important that you not second-guess yourself by thinking about, well, what's going to sell? What's going to be popular with other people? Do the thing that amuses you. Game designer who I know and really respect, Jonathan Mack, who did Everyday Shooter, frequently just says, I just make games that amuse me, and if other people are amused by them, then that's a bonus. And that may be a little callous, but in the long sense, I can't think of how many years in my career as a writer and as a filmmaker I wasted trying to make something that I thought was going to sell as opposed to something that I thought would entertain me. And when I started making things that I genuinely found entertaining, all of a sudden I found out there was an audience for that.
It's amazing how similar this advice is from the top executive film producers and the top music producers. I remember seeing a panel with Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis and Glenn Ballard, you know, some of the biggest, these guys have sold hundreds of millions of records. And everybody was down there at the Guitar Center wanting to hear like that nugget of how do I make my record sound awesome and how do I make it like Janet Jackson or Green Day. And they all mutually across the table agreed that the best song that they had heard produced was I Can't Make You Love Me by Bonnie Raitt. And they were just gobsmacked. And the thing was, he said, it's just the song, man. It's just that she's just singing the song and there's nothing to it. It's so simple. And there's nothing you could do to make it better. And there's no way you could produce that better. It's the essence of the thing. The same thing with film. Now, you know, in this like economic crisis where there's independent distributors just falling left, right, and center, and AFM is a terrified mess of who's going to buy what, no foreign purchasers or anything. And they still say the same thing. They say now is more the time than ever for the independents to do something that it was just going to completely flip us out because we're dying on the vine here. We need those new stories. We need those new voices. And if you're thinking about how you're going to make a sale, you're never going to get there. You've got to be so out of your mind in a way to bring that fresh ground.
If you want to be sort of an emergent guerrilla voice in your art scene, you can't do what everyone else is doing. And particularly in games, but even in all those other mediums, if you make what the big guy is making, there's no way you're going to make, you know, the exact same thing. You're not going to make it as well because he's going to outspend you by 100 to 1.
Yeah.
Easily, if not more. So compete by having a better idea. Compete by taking the advantage of the fact that you don't have to do what those guys do. You're not tied to this idea of only what people think sells. You can experiment and you can make the thing that you care about and love. And that's going to show and that's going to be where you get the great content from every time.
Jesse, any final comments?
Sam said it great. That's exactly how I would have said it.
And that's how the interview went down. We'd like to thank Jesse Vijo and Sam Roberts again for joining us on the Karamcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Karamcast and visit our website at karamcast.com where you can download lots of episodes or you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Thanks a lot for listening. We'll see you next time.